Welcome to Artery with Robert Simpkins and Isa Caveggia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In season three of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist specializing in a particular cultural context has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of voice and authorship in art. In an expansion of our usual interviewer-interviewee format, and in resonance with some of our ongoing discussions on co-creation, in today's episode, we have a larger group. In this episode, Frederick Schmidt, a PhD researcher at the University of Cambridge, and Sarah Park, an associate lecturer in social anthropology at the University of St. Andrews, speak with Elina Ota, an artist, curator, and a co-founder of the artist collective Bisagra, and with Nuno Sassola Marquez, an activist, cinematographer, and filmmaker.
I'm Fred Schmidt, a PhD candidate in the Department of Social Anthropology in Cambridge, and I work on art education across the public and private sectors in Athens, Greece. Amongst other things, I look at how private tutoring provides artists with a livelihood as they're creating conditions of precarity in the patchy funding landscape of post-crisis Athens. I met Eliana and Nuno while I was living in Athens during fieldwork, and having returned to Cambridge, invited them with Sarah to show us their work, A Virtual Sanctuary for Fertilizing Mourning.
I'm Sarah Park, a postdoctoral research and teaching associate in the Department of Social Anthropology at Cambridge. My doctoral research investigated the aftermath of the Sewol ferry disaster in South Korea and the collective mourning and activism of victims' families and citizens who have been demanding investigation and justice from the Korean state.
The work consists of a series of VR films shot using a 360-degree camera that was perched upon Elena's head as they visited indigenous communities in the Peruvian Amazon. These were the Nuevo Amanecer Hawaii, Unipacuyaku, Puerto Nuevo, and Sinchiroca. These communities have long resisted logging and narco-trafficking activities in their territories and have lost their leaders to assassinations in these struggles. The films can be found in the Virtual Sanctuary, a virtual reality environment which is housed on their website, lutaverde.com.
The films follow these communities as they lead the artists on tours through their territories. The work addresses the effects of extractivism and corruption, but also the diverse and rich ways of life being defended as alternatives to capitalist dynamics, and the surviving knowledges passed on among communities resisting centuries of destructive colonization. Using a VR headset, users can navigate the online sanctuary and interact with 3D scanned versions of artifacts that Eliana and Nuno came across during their research visits. These objects thus convey stories around the communities and their deceased leaders that the artists present to the users as a bricolage.
In her work more broadly, Eliana works through the dynamics of mourning and found inspiration in Llana Alpa, the black soil found in the Amazon. The soil dates back to ancient practices of composting organic and inorganic matter together, human remains with pots and ceramics, animal and plant matter. She uses this as a point of departure to ask how mourning can be similarly fertilized and fertilizing. What practices does it set forth and what acts does it inspire? Eliana and Nuno, please tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves.
Well, my name is Eliana Ota. I am originally from Peru. I lived there most of my life until the age of 35. I studied there fine arts, did a master in cultural studies, worked as an artist, as a teacher at the university, and also I was coordinating the curatorial team that made the permanent exhibition for Lugar de la Memoria, which is a national museum dedicated to the period of violence that Peru lived between the 80s and 2000s. And then I came to Europe originally for an artistic residency in Greece and decided to stay longer and apply to a PhD called PhD in Practice program from the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna, which I just finished with a project about trying to collectivize processes of mourning in the context of the Greek crisis through artistic means.
My name is Nuno Cassola. I was born in Portugal in a small village. Then I went to study fine arts in Porto, in the University of Fine Arts, where later I did a master's in art practice. Then I also lived in Brazil for 5 years, where I study documentary filmmaking and also visual anthropology. Then I moved to Greece, where I'm living now in Athens, where I work as a filmmaker and a cinematographer, as a visual artist, and in collaboration and in solidarity and in friendship. I'm part of a collective that I'm one of the co-founders that is called Kora Athens. That is a space for people that need support, where one of the projects that we have there is a social kitchen with free food for everyone that needs.
Can you tell me how Virtual Sanctuary for Fertilizing Morning was created?
Okay, I think that the origins of the project are very much connected to my experience of being a Peruvian migrant in Europe, especially during the pandemic, because I was, on one hand, following the increasing of killings of indigenous leaders and environmental defenders these years while living here at a distance and noticing how little coverage they got in Peru, but in general in big media. And then the situation of the pandemic brought very quickly an escalating amount of deaths in Peru, but also in the Amazon, where initially it was very difficult to translate the situation to the more than 40 languages that are spoken there. And there was a lot of ignorance, but also poor administration of the crisis from the government. So it was very difficult to avoid that the deaths would spread quickly in that area. And that included the deaths of important indigenous leaders and notorious healers and people that had important roles in their communities. So I was following up that at a distance, while also experiencing the impossibility of working in the research I had planned for my PhD, as originally desired, because of the impossibility of working with people, organizing workshops and encounters that my work on collective mourning required. So then while thinking how to adapt to that impossibility and how to try to overcome a sense of paralysis and frustration that I was experienced with the PhD, I started to dedicate some time to do research about the Amazon, and especially in connection to people that has been writing in the last years about a deeper understanding of the entanglements of life, talking about the relationship between humans and non-humans, or more than humans. So I was very much dedicated to this kind of theory, but also writing of, for example, indigenous leaders like David Copenhague from Brazil. And so then I saw a couple of years ago an open call from a German initiative called Driving the Human. And I decided to apply with this project that I named Virtual Sanctuary for Fertilizing Morning, taking inspiration from an indigenous technology for soil regeneration, which is called Llana Alpa. And the idea since the beginning was to develop these virtual tours in the areas where the people that were killed were trying to protect. Also, because of how in that period there were many virtual tours being developed for people to visit from their houses, national parks or museums. So I wanted to try how it would be to adapt this kind of technology to environments where people is living in still, not like these national parks that are normally product of people having been displaced and dispossessed. So, so basically I applied to this call from Driving the Human with the proposal of developing these virtual tours, create a website that would host these tours to make these stories very accessible, because the idea was that they would circulate and try to compensate a little bit the lack of coverage that they normally get, including conversations with the relatives of the deceased people, but also trying to combine mourning with learning and denouncing of these crimes, while showing and these complex webs of relationality that are in these environments, connecting humans and other than humans. And then luckily, this project was accepted by Driving the Human, and then I could have the funding and the time to dedicate a period to develop with this project with Nuno Casola and with the collaborators from Peru, especially the team called Hermanos Magia, directed by Gabriela Laiza, who is also a Peruvian artist and who was in charge of designing and making the programming and the VR version of the experience.
What does authorship mean to you? When art making is collaborative, how do you decide who is the author?
Personally, I don't care much about authorship, I have to say. Even including my own ideas, I don't mind that other people grab them and they try to implement it and try to materialize them. So I feel very at ease to reply to this question. In this sense, I feel very grateful that I was invited for Eliana to be part of this project and to go along this journey, to think together and to be in the same place, trying to solve problems, trying to solve practical problems, practical issues, to theoretical ones, to social or political problems that we were facing, or artistic ones. So in terms of this collaboration, I think it was very fruitful. It was our first collaboration, kind of a more sustained project or a bigger project, as I can call it. So in this sense, I really don't see a point on claiming authorship. I think it's more the luck and the time that we are living and the sensitivity that each person has to try to grab what is happening around us, because we are not inventing the wheel. We are not making something new. We are just trying to put together some of the things that already exist and to try to give some meaning and try to give some shape as much as we can in the times that we are living. And also these shapes and these meanings, they are also meaningful to us.
How about the communities you work with? And how far do you consider them to be co-authors of the work?
I think I consider everyone that is part of the project their co-authors, and of course in different intensities. In the sense that we went there to listen to their stories and to listen to their memories, and trying then to collect those memories into a kind of a collective memory bank of each indigenous leader and forest defenders. But I think in these works, that when we claim, or when people claim, that the work is collaborative, or that the structure is horizontal, or that the structure is non-hierarchical, I think this is always seen as a name, like as an objective, as an horizon to reach. And I think each one tries to do the best as they can as to try to merge that objective into the actual work. So I think in our process, we saw ourselves and we felt ourselves and we put ourselves as vehicles for those stories, as mediums, as Eliana taught me like a year and something ago, about this possibility that us people that are living in this planet, we can be mediums for other peoples and other non-peoples and animals and non-animals and humans and more than humans, that we can be these vehicles, these portals for these stories, for these intensities, for these bodies, for these presence to be translated through oneself and being shared with the people that are around us and with the people that are dear to us. And also collaborative in a way that from the beginning we had it clear that it wasn't, that the process that we were going to try to achieve was not a process of going and visiting and staying with these four communities that we went and doing these recordings, listening to these stories, then going home, editing, putting it together, and then showing this process. We had it from the beginning very clear that We were going there. We were going to do at least three visits to those four communities. So the first one, we went there in February of 2022. We recorded, we listened, we had an assemblies. In each village, we had an assembly to begin our process. Then we went back to Athens. We started working on the footage and the audio recordings that we had. Then we put some of the films together. We went back in August. We did projections in all of the village. There were conversations about those same projections that we had, and there were concerns that were raised. There were desires that raised also from those projections, desires that came from the communities that we were there, that we were filming. And then we went back to Athens. We filmed a little bit more in August, then we went back to Athens. We continue editing and putting the project together. Then we return February 2023 to show the final result of our project. So we also did, in February 2023, we did the projections of all the films that we did in each specific village.
I was thinking I wanted to first stress this idea that Nuno mentioned, that the intention for the project from the beginning was trying to reply the question of how can we as artists or communicators or people working with images and sound and stories put our work at the service of life, I would put it this way, like in an expanded sense. And this had to do with how I understood this open call when I first saw it, because it was offering working conditions that are very rare for the art world, and especially for somebody coming from Peru and for us living in Greece, like to have the possibility of dedicating oneself to a long-term project with a fixed income and with just conditions for the people involved in working. So the first question I made to myself was like, what would I do if I would access these resources, and what do I think deserves to be done, or for what should these resources be destined? So this is also how I decided to apply with this idea. This was something that for me was meaningful enough to use these resources, and also then to be the responsible of how these resources were being used, because I was the ultimate responsible towards the people of Driving the Human and in general regarding the communication of the whole project. And I think this is important to mention, because for people that does art in precarious conditions, the use of resources matters a lot. And how we distribute them throughout the time, and with whom do we share them, and if we can work with somebody, like who would we like to collaborate with, also in this sense of where can this money maybe be more useful or appreciated. So those questions were important from the beginning in relation to the project. And then in the process of collaborating with the communities, maybe if the project would have been done entirely in Peru and we would have been able to spend the whole time of developing the project, 1 year and a half or 2 years, if we count the doing the application and research and all of that. So being in a really close relationship with the communities, I could consider them to be sharing more of the authorship. But since that was not the case, because we had specific moments of time in time of discussions and collaborations and receiving feedback and working with that feedback. But again, then the decision, the final decision-making depended mostly of Nuno and me, and to the and lastly was depending on me. So in that sense, I wouldn't say that we can really share authorship in that way with the communities. And also because I think that makes us accountable, like Nuno, and especially me in the kind of responsibilities that we have in how the whole project has a final shape and is communicated, and then also how it can be criticized or discussed with others, because we are working with sensitive issues. And I think there were a lot of ethic and politic questions
as Nuno mentioned before, that we were discussing and that I was also taking in consideration since the beginning. So I think that all of those ethical and political questions are at stake. And then if somebody has something to discuss regarding that, they will come to us or to me. So I think in this sense, the issue of authorship matters somehow, not because of any other interest in private property or something like this, but then in the sense of responsibility, basically.
So the testimonies that you draw on are largely from the female members of the community. How do you think this affects your work?
Well, I think already because of the experience working at Lugar de la Memoria, this museum connected to the period of violence in Peru, I could work with people that has experienced traumatic events and harsh and cruel episodes of violence. And generally, those people are women, because generally the people that is first killed in conditions of war and conflicts are men. So normally the survivors are the wives or daughters or mothers of the men that are usually either directly fighting some war, like in the case of the period of violence in Peru, or in these cases, usually the leadership of these communities is also taken by men. So again, either because of being leaders of, or because of being part of the guardians of the borders of the communities and of the forest, the men are more exposed in that sense to this kind of violence, and the directly affected victims are normally the women. And usually also that implies that there are several orphans that then end up being in charge of, I mean, the woman end up being in charge of orphans. So that was like a natural consequence of how things happen. And also because of me being a female body in this case, using this camera on my head and being the one doing the interviews, I think that helped for them to feel comfortable and to share a lot of their stories. And also because of the lack of recognition that these communities have in Peru, that normally the people from the Amazons are not considered completely citizens. The act of receiving a stranger, somebody that comes from an urban environment, from Lima, or even from Europe, like in our case, it also makes that people feel very eager to share their stories and open up when they feel that this sense of recognition is coming from even farther away than the localities where they move. And something interesting is that sometimes we discussed with some people in the community of the need of having somebody with some sort of authoritarian voice or more objective voice. In one community, there were some men that were asking for us not to only include the testimony of widows, but also to have a voice that would be more objective or something like this. But we basically wanted to include the voices of the people that wanted to speak, that had something to share, and that had strong connections to the people that had been killed. And that was mostly family. You want to add?
Well, the other thing that I wanted to add is just a very practical thing, which is we also maybe unconsciously or subvertly, but maybe unconsciously that we wanted to add or wanted to create a work that is spoken and it's heard mainly by female bodies. Not that the people that are going to witness the work after that we finish are female bodies, but it's just to say that the person that is listening to those stories in the moment that we are recording and the people that are speaking those stories, that are telling those stories, are also mainly female bodies. I think we wanted to go that we wanted to work on that because of the lack of that interaction, because of the lack of that dialectic between those two bodies in film history, film ethnographic history, anthropology history, but like basically the history of moving images, that we wanted to create this place that is focused in this type of voices.
What is the significance of the body in your work? How did you feel that the experience of wearing the VR camera on your head changed or affected the work?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this project wanted to try out how it would be to use these technological tools that are now very popular, mostly in connection to sports, like extreme sports, and then also these virtual tours to natural parks or to places in general that are considered very beautiful. So mostly the camera is static, put on a tripod for the viewer to have this immersion on this beautiful landscape, but it is normally a static position of the camera. So in this case, the idea was that by wearing the camera on my head, since I was going to be getting to know these territories, basically being guided by the people that lives there, and then the viewer, the user of the VR experience or the viewer of the videos, would have the access to this experience of following somebody that knows the territory or have the experience of somebody that is being offered and that is being welcomed and hosted in these territories that are threatened by all these different conflicts. So the idea was that the viewer could be as close as possible to my own experience of getting to know the place, so that the viewer is in close relationship to an embodied experience of a place and the engagement that implied in relationship to the inhabitants of these communities. So in the videos we see many times that somebody is offering me a plate of food, or that I am sharing food with somebody, or that I am learning how to shoot an arrow with very bad results, or different images that show this interaction between my body and the others, so that there is an engagement that implies a subject-to-subject relationship. It is very opposed to an old tradition of research or of learning that pretends to have some distance and objective attitude, and that approaches something as an object of study while the researcher is thought or constructed as this subject. So in this case, everything had to do with subject-to-subject relationships, not only with humans, but also with the trees and the rivers and the mountains, and trying to make everything familiar to the cosmovisions of the places that we were inhabiting and getting to know through our guests. So in this sense, also, we were interested in using this immersive experience because of the generous and almost sometimes overwhelming sensation of being in the rainforest. That is an environment where you don't know where to look. You see life everywhere, and life and death helping each other in this cycle of regeneration of life regarding the soils and the animals and everything that exists. So we wanted to find means of translating this belonging of the body to this very dense network of relationships and just flows of energies and mothers helping each other to grow and continue existing somehow. Maybe you want to add something?
That was the uses of the camera, the one that it was strapped on Eliana's head, as was the intention of having this subjective point of view, and especially to have a movement that it's not controllable from a camera point of view. So usually when we would use any ordinary camera or a phone camera that we have, we kind of point to the things that we want to film, and we kind of plan the movement that we are going to do with this camera from point A to point B. So I'm going to start in the face of someone, then going for the hands, then going to the face again, then going maybe to a plate of food or a rock or a plant. In this case, is the whole body that is this movement. So it's like the organic movement of someone that is just being guided, is being welcomed, is being received, is being taken care of by. So it's a movement, a body that is moving to adapt and to understand what is happening. So it's in this case a very subjective point of view, very subjective camera, very engaged camera, which is in contradiction with most of the VR experience that we saw until now, that some of them, as Aliana mentioned before, are ones that are on the tripod mainly, that we see in natural parks, museums, monuments, famous squares, famous spots in cities. Or, for example, some of them that I saw that are using a very classic National Geographic style, that on top of being a camera on a tripod, the relationship between the camera and the people that the camera is filming is a very unbalanced relationship, because it's as if the camera is stealing someone from the people that are filming, as if the people that are around, that usually is a celebration or a dance or a big feast, that people are kind of overcompensating the opportunity that camera, that is of course very connected with the West, that is like they are trying to overcompensate and justifying the gratitude that camera or that body or that institution went to their reality to be filmed and then later to be shared with the rest of the world. So in our case, I think you can see in some of the situations also the quality of the image is not perfect all the time because of the conditions that we were going through. Sometimes it's a little bit blurry, sometimes it's a little bit flimsy, but I think all of this adds on this more embodied camera that is not planned, basically. There is not such a big plan behind almost every action.
Eliana, you talk about Llana Alpa, the Amazonian technique of making black soil through composting human remains and organic matter, plant matter. And how far does the mediality and materiality of the VR experience materialize this process of fertilizing or composting mourning?
I think that on a conceptual and political level, the idea was to take inspiration from that practice, in the sense of a practice that was merging pragmatic, experience-based agriculture knowledge with spiritual knowledges and beliefs and ways of relating with the environment. So for me, it was important that this project could depart from that conviction of the need of merging realms that are normally understood as separated, as by example politics and spirituality, and then merging practices of mourning with those of political struggle and also of learning and remembering and passing on messages and tasks. So to work in a messy way, like contaminating things with each other. And then regarding the methodology, I think that the VR and this 360 camera that records everything around you that you can't really control unless you edit a portion of the image. But in this case, we left the 360 videos open so that the viewer chooses what to see. It also implies that there is nothing that you are disregarding. There is nothing that is being considered unuseful or as waste, talking about images. It's everything is incorporated and everything has the potentiality of being understood in a certain way that can be interesting depending on who is the viewer and who is watching what and from which position, from which background, and with the capacities to make what connections. So I think it was very interesting to work in this way with these 360 images to be able then in the editing part to acknowledge what was happening, like, let's say, behind me in my back or the, or these places that I couldn't perceive while actually recording the images, and then just cutting because there were thousands of hours of material and we had to make some films out of them. But then there was no cutting in the sense of choosing a specific frame, but it was leaving everything open to the viewer.
In anthropology, there is a long-standing critique of the salvage paradigm of early anthropologists, who saw native communities as representatives of a tradition on the brink of extinction through modernity. The critique goes that these anthropologists accelerated this process through their being there, and their photos and films are today seen as having captured or trapped the community's essence. Do you think VR produces a more dynamic and active sort of record? How did the communities react to the technology?
Well, particularly with the VR, I think there is no more or less dynamic because it's a tool. And I think in terms of the technology, it maybe to make it a little bit more difficult because it's a technology that is not very accessible to most of us. So the camera is expensive. You would need a very good computer also to edit. The type of microphones that we use also, they are not the cheapest ones to use. But I think it's all about the way that you work with this technology in relation with the other. The way that we were working wasn't with the intention of capturing any essence. We were more focused on the memories that everyone was willing to share with us about their leaders and about their forest defenders. And at the same time, using that as an excuse to learn more and to listen more about their relationship with the territory. So it's not that one technology or one tool is going to break the cycle or break the dynamics that are deep in our understanding of the other. And they are informed by the films that we watch, the ethnographic films that we watch, or the fictions or the documentaries. So I think it's way more important the way that we use the tools than so much the tools that you are using. So VR, VR itself could be seen, but it could be seen as this solution for the engagements of people or engagements that people would have in different environments, in landscapes or in monuments or in the different realities. But at the same time, could also be part of the continuous promises that we received from the technology world, naming the internet or the invention of apps for the iPhone and now the artificial intelligence or the renditions of the artificial intelligence that we have that is always promising us more time and more enjoyment and more engagement with people. But I think it's way more important the way that we use it critically than just to use or just to somehow just to buy those promises or just to go with those promises. At the same time, the reaction that people were having with the VR device itself, it was very difficult to explain, which I think I would I would have the same difficulty that I would have to explain how VR works to anyone in this world, because it's also a very bizarre technique to use, or a very bizarre camera to use. It's as if, because we are very used to having just one lens that is filming something, as we are, that are mimicking a lot the way that we watch. So then to explain to someone that this very small device is both filming the thing that you see in front of you and the thing that you see on the back of you, it's it demands a lot of translation and demands a lot of trying to use different language and trying to use more, trying to use language and images that we would learn throughout this journey, which is to, And not so much to use the same words that I use in different contexts. It's just like somehow adapting my language and my images to the context that that I was living, that I was sharing, to be understood.
I would add only that in every community, everybody was very curious and receptive of the things that we were doing and the machines, the devices that we were bringing. Of course, especially children, they are always very eager to learn and to play with what is being brought by a stranger. But also the adults were very curious and happy to be part of the making of the things, and also of giving feedback whenever we were showing the videos that we made. And also each time that they go to a city or to a place with internet, they communicate. They use WhatsApp, they have some of them Facebook profiles, or they were requesting the links for us, for us to send the links so that they would try to watch the videos. So it was an attitude of openness and of trying to get the best out of each thing when the conditions allowed for that. No, like most communities don't have electricity. But the minute that they can get it, they want to get it. And the same with internet and everything else. So in this sense, it made sense to be able to share those resources as well.
Eliana and Nuno, as artists, could you tell us what kinds of political possibilities might be opened up through artistic and creative forms, perhaps in ways that more overtly political forms of resistance might not be able to?
I think that everything that we do is political and has political connotations. It doesn't matter if you're an artist or an anthropologist or a lawyer or a teacher or I don't know. Okay, we will have to think about
shoemaker.
I was going to say dentist. But but yes, I think like everything we do has a political dimension to it, and it depends on each of us to understand that and to engage with that depending on how do we feel connected to a specific context. For me, a question that was made by a person that is actually a death doula a couple of years ago within the pandemic, when she was trying to overcome the death of her sister, was the question of what do these times demand from me, or what do these times ask from me? And since I heard that question, it naturally started to become like a companion of my artistic work and other kind of works that I do. So that in general, I try to think or consider how the different projects and collaborations I take part of reply that question and help me to feel also energized as a person and as a artist in a context or in times that are very uncertain and hopeless somehow. So I think that if we find things that give us life and that make us feel that we are doing something slightly meaningful and that maybe help others to feel also less lonely and more strong or joyful, I think a combination of that is what I find also very political, and especially regarding the issue of mourning and loss, I have seen in these years how acknowledging losses has a big value in times in which many lives are considered ungrievable and valuable. So the opportunity to build up this sense of meaning together is something that I consider very transformative, and that luckily art many times has some tools or at least some intuitions that can be explored to go in that direction.
For me, art is this territory that you can do most of the things that a lot of people can do. There is a lot of freedom, there is a lot of debate, there is a lot of, it's a very, very fruitful terrain for people to dwell, can be political. I think everything, I agree with Eliana. I think all of us, whatever that we do, whatever that we think, though, however we move and however we perform is a political act. In arts, there is an addition of a layer of freedom, because there is not, even though there are some rules that maybe some books they tell us that exists, and these are the rules of this artistic movement or artistic practice, in the end you can actually do a lot of the things that you might imagine that you couldn't do, and if you, and then maybe you could consider that art. But in a way, it's, I think for me, for example, art, it allows me, or me telling myself, or me identifying myself as an artist, allows me to, through some ideas or some desires, to put myself in situations and to meet people that actually change the way that I see the world. I think it's more the reverse, that I somehow have some intentions or some ideas, desires, intuitions, that through the world of art and through its meanders and through its rules and non-rules allows me to grow as a human and allows me to be more intentional of the things that I'm trying to do, and at the same time trying to learn also from this advice of trying to see what these times demands from us. And art as this, you can just explore so much, and this doesn't mean that it's a nihilistic effort, that it's just on your own, having a piece of paper in front of you and a pencil on your hand, or you are just in front of the computer and you are oblivious of what is happening around you. I think there is a big dialectic between the act of surviving and the act of living with the act of doing art, because I think both of them, they feed from each other and they can be potentialized mutually. Also the act of death and the consciousness that and the awareness that life and death are both the same things. I think the only expectation that might exist in art is for experimentation. And I think this is a true gift that we have while we are alive, is just to experiment. As we are human beings, we are experimental beings.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins and Isa Caveggia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. Thank you for listening. Join us in a fortnight for the next episode in this season on voice and authorship in art.